We're going to start off by speaking with Ali Abu Nima. He's a Palestinian-American. He's the co-creator and editor of the Electronic Intifada website since 2001, and Electronic Iraq and Electronic Lebanon. He's a graduate of Princeton University and the University of Chicago, and he's written for the Chicago Tribune, among other publications. He also has an excellent book that I highly recommend. It's called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. I'm very pleased to be joined by Ali Abu Nima today. Hello, Ali.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Of course. Thanks so much. So I want to start off by just mentioning that, of course, people know, if they've been listening to this station at all, about the recent Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip. It went on for 22 days. It left more than 1,300 Palestinians dead, 5,000 injured, 4,000 homes destroyed, and about 17,000 others were damaged. Entire neighborhoods were wiped out. There was 13 Israelis killed as well, three of whom were civilians in this 22-day period. Now, my understanding is that Israel, you know, declared a ceasefire on January 22nd, a unilateral ceasefire, and a day later, Hamas did the same. But 5 days after Israel declared a ceasefire, Israeli gunboats shelled the Gaza coast, and they injured six, including four children. Then in an incident later that day, injured five fishermen in other attacks. There's been other attacks beyond that, but I'm just wondering if you can talk about the ceasefire and... you know, there's been a lot of talk about how we need to desperately to maintain it, but is it even being respected?
Well, that's of course you're right. Israel, in the days after the ceasefire, so-called ceasefire, began shelling the beaches, and they admitted that, and they said that was to prevent fishermen going out. So that gives you an idea of what an Israeli ceasefire is. And then, of course, yesterday, there was an attack by Palestinian resistance which killed an Israeli occupation soldier on the Gaza-Israel boundary. And the media in this country immediately said this was the first breach of the ceasefire. So as usual, all Israeli military actions and attacks on civilians are ignored. And then we hear when there's violence affecting Israelis, all of a sudden we're told about it. But I think the bigger violence that is continuing to take place, also let me mention, incidentally, that there is a huge amount of unexploded ordnance dropped by Israel that continues to pose a real risk to life and limb of Palestinians. And at least two children have been reported killed by unexploded ordnance since the so-called Israeli ceasefire. But the bigger violence is that Israel is maintaining the blockade and the siege, which is continuing to kill people because medical supplies can't get in an adequate number, and Israel is still maintaining the siege on Gaza. That has not changed.
What role does Egypt play in that siege, in that blockade?
Egypt is a full partner in the blockade because they could open the border fully. Now, they've let in yesterday, a team of doctors from Illinois, from the American Muslim Association of North America, got into Gaza in recent days. But this is very restricted and, you know, with a lot of difficulty. So the Egyptians, who are, you know, working hand in hand with Israel, are continuing this attempt to try to blackmail the Palestinian leadership in Gaza to meet Israel's conditions. And of course, what's so immoral and illegal and scandalous about this is they're using food and medicine and water and movement, you know, the right to enter or leave your own country, as a way to blackmail a democratically elected political leadership. You know, if that is not terrorism on a massive scale, then that word has just no meaning whatsoever.
Why is it that Egypt is working so closely with Israel on this?
Egypt is one of the so-called moderate regimes in the region. And what moderate means is that basically you're in a client-patron relationship with the United States. You're an American satellite state, just as the Soviet Union had its satellite state in Europe during the Cold War. So these are American satellite states, and you know, moderate has nothing to do with democracy or religion. You know, you can be a brutal dictatorship like Mubarak's Egypt and we'll call you a moderate. You can be, you know, just an unbelievably repressive theocratic state like Saudi Arabia, and we will call you a moderate. And you can be a racist ethnocracy in apartheid state like Israel, and we'll call you a democracy. So this has nothing to do with the nature of the regime. It has to do with the fact that they are allied with the United States in its continuing efforts to maintain its hegemony in the region that it has sought since 1945, since the British and the French left as the colonial powers. So that's what this is about. And if you resist American power in any way, if you believe that the region should be free to determine in its own future, that's what we call an extremist.
Now, the argument for not lifting the blockade is that if they lift the blockade, especially along the Israel border, that they're risking potential, it's a security risk to Israel. And then on the Egypt border, at least from the Israeli point of view, the argument is, well, we need to stop the smuggling of arms into Gaza, because then that'll just create more problems for us. How would you respond to that?
Well, we published a very nice article just on this very point on the Electronic Intifada today about the myth that this is all about rockets. And just in full disclosure, it's by my dad, who is a writer on these issues and from whom I learned so much of what I know, Hassan Abu Nama. But he takes on this exact claim that this is all about the rockets and smuggling rockets. And that, you know, this myth of the rockets is to try to reduce the issue of Palestine, which at its root is about the dispossession of an entire nation, to an issue of rockets, and it's absurd. I mean, basically, the logic is that, you know, Hamas is firing rockets just because they have access to them. And, you know, therefore, if you stop the supply of rockets, there will be peace. I mean, this is treating the symptoms in the most superficial and dishonest and cynical way. And, of course, the other side of that is, I mean, you have this shameful display of European countries and the United States sending their navies now to help Israel blockade Gaza under the pretext of stopping rockets. I mean, Gaza has been blockaded for 2 years already. You know, people are dying and starving because of this blockade. They're dying for lack of medicine. And how much more blockade do they think is going to stop rockets? I mean, resistance, not just Hamas, other resistance groups were able to get rockets or the materials to make them despite this blockade. So how much tighter are they going to make it? And of course, the really shocking and shameful thing is all these countries rushed to offer to send their navies to blockade Gaza for Israel, but not one of them offered to send a hospital ship to help the thousands of people who have been horribly injured. You know, as if helping a child severely burned by white phosphorus or just dying for lack of water is somehow supporting terrorism or extremism. The morality of this is just, you know, what is in the article I mentioned, is that this is, you know, the Europeans, I think morally it's on the same scale as how so many Europeans watched as the Nazis took away Jewish people in the trains and they did nothing. I'm not saying it's the same as that, but morally it's similar when you watch a great evil going on and you can do something and you choose not to.
And the article you're referring to, again, is called The Shortcut to Peace.
Right, Shortcut to Peace, or The Shortcut to Peace. Maybe you can see it.
Yeah, I actually read it earlier, and one part that stood out to me was this paragraph where Hassan writes, "In the better past, when war broke out in a region, the immediate response was often to impose an arms embargo on all sides. But when the defenseless population in Gaza were under attack from the region's strongest army, all calls were to prevent the victims from defending themselves. Meanwhile, endless supplies of sophisticated weaponry were sent to the occupier despite its already massive dominance and indiscriminate and criminal attacks on civilians." So not only is the United States helping out in the blockade and some of these European countries, but they're arming one side very, very heavily.
Yes. And people are, you know, starting to catch on to this and to act. And one thing that really impressed me is that You know, in the United Kingdom, all over the country, it's about 17 universities, students have staged occupations and sit-ins to demand that their universities be accountable on this issue. And at the London School of Economics, the students demanded that their university divest from BAE Systems, which is a major British arms company, one of the biggest arms companies in the world, which sells weapons to Israel. And they staged a sit-in until the university agreed to, you know, to discuss divestment and, you know, to begin a process of talking about that. And, of course, in Greece, during the height of the bombardment, the United States, it was revealed in the Israeli press, that the United States was sending a massive shipload of weapons to Israel in the midst of the bombing that was leaving from a port in Greece. And you know, dock workers and unions and people that said, no way, we will have nothing to do with this. And they stopped that shipment from going to Israel. So, you know, things can be done and things are being done to start to change the situation and hold people accountable.
I do want to focus a little bit more, a little longer on this emphasis that's placed on the rockets. Professor Stephen Zunas, he's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. I've interviewed him many times on Free Radio Santa Cruz. He says even if they could stop all weapons or the basic materials needed to make rockets from coming through these tunnels or wherever else they're coming from, that it wouldn't stop, because not only it's not, as you said, you know, just because they have a supply of rockets that they're firing them. There's other reasons for this. But Stephen says that they have the raw materials they need to make the rockets right there in Gaza. They don't even need to import anything.
Right.
So focusing on that doesn't really seem to be, it's not fair for one thing, but it doesn't make practical sense.
Exactly. And that's right. It's not really about the rockets. What it is it's about toppling resistance in general, and Hamas in particular. What they would like to see is Palestinians give up their struggle to be free, and to the extent that Hamas is a mass-based resistance movement that people have chosen to represent them, they want to destroy it and stop it. They would like to have pliant puppet Palestinian leaders who collaborate with the Israeli occupation like they have in the West Bank. That's what they want. That is the problem, is that there is resistance and that Palestinians are not quietly accepting their fate as, you know, basically inmates of a giant ghetto or prison camp that Israel has established for them just because they're unwanted human beings. Palestinians won't accept that. That is what Israel's problem is.
What do you make of the appointment of George Mitchell as Mideast envoy?
Well, I think that Mitchell, you know, of course he's an establishment figure, but I think people were, it shows how low our expectations have come that, you know, Dennis Ross or Martin Indyk or some other lifelong pro-Israel activist from the Israel lobby, that someone like that wasn't appointed. You know, people said, wow, you know, that's great. Mitchell, of course, is distinguished by two things. One is, well, actually, three things. One is his report on steroid use in baseball. I'm not sure how relevant that is. But the other is that back in 2000, President Clinton sent him to lead a mission to investigate the causes of violence in the context of the second Palestinian uprising. And that report was, you know, coming from a mainstream American politician, pretty okay. You know, he basically said that, you know, all violence should stop. Israeli violence should stop and Palestinian violence should stop. I mean, that's a radical position these days because, you know, Bush, Rice, Obama, Clinton all say now only Palestinian violence should stop, and they actually openly endorse Israeli violence. So, you know, that's pretty radical. And, of course, he insisted that all Israeli settlement activities stop. So that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is his role in Northern Ireland, where he is very highly respected by all sides in that conflict and is given credit for helping broker that deal. Although I've been reading about it, and as usual, you find that the role of grassroots organizations, particularly feminist and working class groups has been written out of that history, but they played a crucial role as well. Anyway, let's give Mitchell the credit. What made the difference in Northern Ireland was that Mitchell was, you know, the British, of course, didn't want to talk to Sinn Féin and the IRA. They said, they're the terrorists, they're the extremists, we're not going to talk to them. Well, Mitchell insisted they have to be part of the process or you can't make peace. And the Irish-American lobby actually played a beneficial role by, you know, putting pressure on the U.S. government to do that. And in fact, there was also a divestment campaign to force companies in Northern Ireland not to discriminate against Catholics, as they've been doing. So there, American politics played a beneficial role in helping peace. In this case, it's the opposite. You have the pro-Israel lobby that actually works against peace by getting the United States to pressure the weaker side to favor the stronger side. And, of course, Obama has stuck by George Bush's ban on having any contact with Hamas. So I would say that, you know, Mitchell could be the right person to do this job, but if the policies don't change, then he's going to fail. And in particular, he has to be allowed to talk to Hamas.
Now, Obama has made a recent statement, to my knowledge, is that the blockade should be lifted. Also,
he didn't say the blockade should be lifted.
No, he didn't. What did he say?
Well, what he said is that the blockade should be lifted with an appropriate monitoring mechanism with the participation of the international community and the Palestinian Authority. Now, you might say, well, what does that mean? What it means is that he's actually saying in practice the blockade should be maintained. He's not saying it should be lifted. He's talking about, exactly what we were talking about earlier, European countries sending their navies or sending troops to police the borders of Gaza on behalf of Israel. Because this is what existed after 2005. Israel, you know, when it pulled its settlers out of Gaza and withdrew its army to the perimeter and continued besieging Gaza, they did not open the borders until there was a so-called international monitoring regime whereby European monitors, so-called European monitors, simply performed the role of proxy occupation soldiers on Israel's behalf. And right now, and the other part of that is that when he says the Palestinian Authority, he's talking about the, you know, Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank, whose term has expired, who has these American-trained so-called security forces that are basically collaborating with Israel. So what he's saying is that the borders should be under Israeli control, but we should conceal that Israeli control by either having U.S.-trained Palestinian security forces or Europeans there. That's what he's saying.
What's the alternative?
The alternative is to open the borders. I mean, if Israel really ended its occupation of Gaza like it claims, then the borders should be open. People should be able to come and go. And, you know, if you don't want weapons coming in, you know, weapons are not a problem of you know, as we were saying earlier, Palestinians are not fighting any more than Irish people were just because they want to fight. They're fighting because there's injustice that is unaddressed. So you open the borders, you let people have a dignified life, and you address the injustice. That, you know, that's what the title to that article is that we were talking about, A Shortcut to Peace. This is not a police or security problem. This is a problem of injustice. And everyone wants a shortcut. What's the short solution? You know, what's the border regime that we could have that solves this problem? There isn't one. The solution is justice.
Well, what about security for both Gaza and Israel?
It seems like a very, you know, we talk about security for Israel, but it's Palestinians that are under, and have always been, since Israel was established and since before, the ones under threat.
I said for both Gaza and Israel.
Of course, security has to be for both. But what Israel has been saying in practice is security for us and insecurity for everyone else. And that's the formula that won't work. Security has to be for everyone. And Gaza, people in Gaza can't have security if they're living in a giant cage. They can't have physical security. They can't have mental security. They can't have food security, health security, economic security. All that is absent from Gaza because they're living in a giant cage.
Let's talk a little bit about the two-state solution, because I know it's a very long discussion and we can't get into it too much now because you've got to go soon, but that is the kind of default, quote, solution that's always put forward, but it's becoming more and more clear that that isn't really going to be an option much longer, if it even is now, because of the almost absolute takeover of the West Bank by not only Israel controlling it through the occupation, but these settlements, these, quote, facts on the ground that continue to grow and grow. And just recently on 60 Minutes, a couple of nights ago, they aired a piece that, by the way, people should go to intheoccupation.org, the website for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, and watch that. And there's also a way to thank CBS for airing it, that talks about this, that says basically Israel has three options: ethnic cleansing, which they say isn't going to work in this day and age, which it seems like that is kind of what's happening now. They say apartheid, but apartheid regimes don't last long. And then they say give everyone their democratic rights, but Israel doesn't want that because they no longer have a Jewish majority. So then they go and talk to Mustafa Barghouti, who says apartheid already exists.
Right.
What do you think of... It seems that maybe there is a shift, very slight, maybe not huge just yet, taking place where people seem to be coming to grasp the fact that the two-state solution is very likely dead at this point. What do you think of that trend?
Well, I think that shift is definitely coming. It's what I predicted several years ago, and people said, oh, you're crazy, you know, and even when my book, you know, when it first came out, people said, this is nuts. And what you find now is that in the mainstream, people are talking about the fact that the two-state solution is finished, and they're talking about a one-state solution. Even Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter is going around. He was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart the other night, talking about, you know, saying, I'm not in favor of a one-state solution, but this has got to be discussed. It's unavoidable now. And you know, there are still those people who are going to bury their heads in the sand and say, no, this isn't happening. And but that's where we are at this point. And I think that that's going to escalate. It's going to become unavoidable that a two-state solution is finished. And what needs to happen is some kind of democratic solution that gives everyone who lives in the country their rights, whether it's, you know, some kind of confederation or some kind of power sharing like in Northern Ireland or a single democratic state. The discussion will have to move towards what they called in Northern Ireland an equality agenda. That, you know, there are all kinds of disadvantages, and so an equality agenda can address also disadvantages that some Israeli Jews are experiencing. So you have a large number of very poor, very marginalized Israeli Jews who are not served by this dichotomous division of Jew versus Palestinian, but who could begin to see their own interests met in the context of a much broader equality agenda. I think that's where the discussion will have to move.
Is there any real support for that either on the Palestinian side or in Israel?
I think it's growing, but you can't really measure the support until we've had the discussion. And I think that there has been so much resistance to the discussion in the past couple of years, and that resistance is starting to break down. So, you know, give people a chance to discuss it, to explore the ideas. I mean, I'm really impressed. I'm reading this book now about the role that the kind of untold story that women's groups and prisoners groups played in bringing peace to Northern Ireland. That, you know, the politicians in the suits were unable to break the stalemate, but you had this incredible amount of grassroots activity that changed the discourse and that, you know, kind of said, let's approach this from a different angle. Let's forget about, or not forget about, but, you know, we understand that people are concerned and obsessed by state sovereignty and self-determination and nationalism, but, you know, let's look at what people really need in their lives. They need equality, they need dignity, they need all the, you know, and that you find then that on both sides of the divide, there are people who need those things. So you can begin to have a conversation that crosses those lines. And I think that it's a very powerful story that, you know, doesn't, the kind of the diplomatic narrative where it was a bunch of men who got together in a room and hammered out a deal, doesn't do justice to it. And so those are the things I'm trying to learn from and see how we can really start to break this impasse.
It does feel a bit hopeless, though. When you look at the situation, it's, I think, about over 90% of the Israeli public supported the assault on Gaza. And you have just this really polarized situation, an extremely divided and polarized situation at this point, which is why the whole two-state solution appealed so much to a lot of people, including in Israel and Palestine. But as you pointed out and others now, this two-state solution is basically history at this point because of, quote, facts on the ground, the Israeli settlements, the bypass roads, the confiscation of Palestinian land, the demolition of Palestinian homes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, but on the other hand, I don't know, it seems like a really hopeless situation because you've got such a polarized and divided situation, and yet you can't divide, you can't partition, because that's not going to work at this point. But can you really have a unified society when there's so much, has been so much violence and so much oppression? I mean, well, how would that even work?
Well, that's the question that is always asked in these situations. And it is true that the levels of violence, just the sheer scale of violence, never approached this in Northern Ireland. But people would say exactly the same thing. They would say, you know, that the polarization is so great. It's very interesting. The journalist Patrick Coburn, who is of Irish origin and you know, lived in Belfast and has been a reporter in Palestine and Iraq, recently wrote an article from Jerusalem where he said the atmosphere in Jerusalem among Israeli Jews is exactly like it was among unionists, the Protestant unionists who were in control in Belfast in the 1960s, one of total denial, you know, just a total inability to see why the rest of the world would object to their conduct. And that, you know, in a way, he's saying that it took until now for Israelis' attitudes to get as bad as they were in Northern Ireland 30 or 40 years ago. So, to me, these are lessons that polarization, this kind of hatred, is a product of entrenched systemic injustice and inequality that breaks down principally, in this case, along national lines, along kind of these ethno-national lines. But, you know, in each community, you're going to find that the most marginalized people are women and the poor, and you know, there are different communities there who are going to be marginalized on both sides and whose voices cannot emerge in this kind of dichotomous nationalist discourse. And that's one of the lessons for me, is that people began to break through when they started to have a broader conception of what equality is.
Final question. How would you even begin a one-state solution? Would you just, would Israel annex the West Bank and Gaza and give everyone in those two areas, all the Palestinians living there, citizenship and the right to vote? And then you would, I mean, how would you even begin that?
I would begin it by talking about it. And that's what I've been trying to do. You can't jump from one thing to the other. You have to begin with the discussion. You have to start including people in the discussion of what would you like your society to look like? What do you want for yourself and what do you want for your children? That's the starting point, is to begin to have that discussion. And the other part of it is, frankly, that there has to be pressure on Israel, that the Israeli population is in this kind of hyper-nationalistic mode where it is isolated from the consequences of its actions, very much like Protestant unionists in Northern Ireland or whites in South Africa. So the real world has to intrude on them to get them to start changing the way they think. And that's why the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is important, because what it says in a nonviolent way is the status quo is untenable. You have to start thinking about change. You cannot have the luxury of living, you know, a normal life while these horrors are going on in the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank or, you know, for Palestinians inside Israel. in the refugee camps around, you have to start to feel some of the cost of this, again, in a nonviolent way, just like the sanctions in South Africa. But the other part of that has to be to begin to have this discussion of what next, where do we go? And that discussion is happening. And that's, you know, I could give you a blueprint and say, here's what you do, here's step 1 to 10 to have a two-state solution, but it's meaningless. What matters is to begin to build visions that a lot of people have participated in. And that's, I'm very hopeful that that's starting to happen.
I've been speaking with Ali Abu Nima. He is the co-creator and editor of the Electronic Intifada website since 2001 and the author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Thanks so much for joining me today, Ali. Uh-oh, I lost Ali.
Oh, thank you very much. I was muted for a second, but...
Maybe I can steal one more question from you.
Sure you can.
Do you think you'll see peace in Israel and Palestine in your lifetime?
I believe it's possible. I really do. And I would like to see it not just in my lifetime, but in my parents' lifetime. And that would mean more to me than anything.
Yeah, your father originally from Jerusalem, right?
Yes, both of my parents born in Palestine. My father from what's now the West Bank near Bethlehem, and my mother from West Jerusalem, what's now in Israel.
Have they been able to go home at all?
They have been once since 1967. In 1997, we went together, and it was a very difficult and emotional experience, and it's an experience that you know, some Palestinians have had being able to go back, but, you know, many millions of others have never had the chance even to visit. And that's really part of what makes it so painful.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Ali. I really appreciate it. And we'll be talking to you again, I'm sure, in the near future.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Again, that was Ali Abu Nima, and he is the author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. I can't recommend it highly enough. It is absolutely essential reading on this subject.